I feel the love.
Okay, we'll bring the meeting of the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee to order, and we'll start with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer. Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornes.
Here.
Slocum. And Smith.
Here.
Okay, thank you. And having a quorum present here, we will receive a motion from someone to approve the minutes for February 9th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Hilty moves the minutes of February 9th. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Members, today we're going to be hearing House File 306. Would somebody like to move the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nornes.
I'd like to move House File 306.
House File 306 is moved, and for the committee members' information here, what we're going to be doing is laying this bill over and the amendments. And we have the hearing today, and then we'll lay it over and bring it up at a later time. Any questions about that motion? Okay, hearing none, the bill is before us, House File 306. Representatives Westrum and Nornes, are you both going to
present? I think I'll stay here.
Before we start, today is going to be a hearing that we've heard before. There's going to be very emotional testimony, very serious testimony. I would like the members here to remember that a loss of life has occurred. However you feel about this bill, with your passion for or against, to keep it respectful. And the meeting will probably take up most of our time and towards noon. And is there anybody here that wishes to testify for or against this bill that isn't on our schedule? Okay. Representative, yes, sir.
What's your?
Thank you. And you? Unfortunately, our technology doesn't allow us to leave our cell phones on, so if anybody's got one on, please turn it off. And otherwise, that's that mess you hear. The chair is now turning his off. Best way I've found is to take the battery out. All right, Representative Westrum, your bill is before us.
Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Thank you. And I have no objection because I think that's a good. We used to do that too. I just wanted to make sure. We were wondering, we'd still get like discussion of it or something when you bring it back or
yes.
Something.
Discussion and amendments and okay. Going over the fiscal note, everything that we would normally do.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Westrum, if you would go ahead with your presentation to House File 306, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. House File 306, known as Emily's Law, is before us again, revised some from previous years. But the goal and objective here is to improve our juvenile justice system and not have glaring omissions of injustice, which have occurred, in my opinion, in Representative Nornes' opinion, in many people's opinion, once you hear the facts and the outcome of the case of Emily Johnson. Emily Johnson was 2 years old, and I'll just touch on the story. The family is here, Lynn and Travis Johnson from Fergus Falls, and their daughter was killed in a daycare by a 13-year-old who was 3 weeks short of being 14, and because of that, received an extremely light sentence compared to what would have potentially happened if he would have been 14 or older. Because of the age of certification as an adult or the EJJ system, this person fell through the cracks, or he simply, in my estimation, and many people's estimation, received a light sentence for the horrendous crime he committed. The two-year-old, I'll let the family share the story, but members, this morning I woke up, and I thought it was ironic. The top two stories you probably saw on the news dealt with juveniles and crimes of murder. The one instance was the Theodore Park situation, a gang initiation, 17-year-old with two accomplices that were 14 and 16, received 23 years in prison, 15 years before parole. That's in our current system, but he was certified as an adult, as I understand the news report, and that's the severity of the penalty that they rightfully should have faced. Another situation, Michael Swanson, a more recent case, known as the Iowa murderer. If you recall, he drove from the Twin Cities down to Iowa, robbed two convenience store clerks, and because he didn't want any witnesses alive, they complied with what he wanted, gave him what he wanted, but he didn't want any witnesses, and he murdered him. 17 years old. We've got a video clip here we're going to show the committee that talks about his troubled life started preteen. So, members, the reason for this bill is I think it's time we need to re-examine 14 as the age to become designated EJJ or be certified as an adult. There's a letter that is being handed out from the county attorney in Ottertail that handled this matter with the Johnsons. Their hands were tied. They could not petition the court for certification as an adult, nor could they petition to designate that juvenile EJJ. And let me just bring your attention to a handout I gave the committee. I believe it's passed around, but it's from House Research, because it was helpful for me to also get my mind around EJJ and what EJJ is in our system now, as well as the adult certification. But if you want to look at that, members, if you're not familiar with EJJ, I think that's a helpful quick read to understand. We've got essentially three systems: a juvenile adjudication system, which is where the candy bar stealer or the hubcap person who steals hubcaps that's 13, 14, 15 years old might get adjudicated in our current system and dealt with for crimes that are less significant. The EJJ system deals with felony crimes, and if somebody's a juvenile, they can be designated EJJ if they're 14 or older and receive a juvenile sentence, but they would also receive an adult sentence at the same time. And that adult sentence would hang over their head, and if they violate their sentence or probation, they've got that adult sentence they're facing if they don't comply and don't reform and don't shape up and become a good, productive member of our society. That didn't apply to the person who killed Emily Johnson. Then you've also got the adult certification. And in the case where the courts would review this, the courts review this in all the cases. And in the memo I gave you, it lists the elements and the issues that the court reviews, and the attorneys for either side have to present why the person should be designated EJJ or certified as an adult. So it's not a foregone conclusion that just lowering the age from 14 to 10, that those juveniles committing felony injuries, felony crimes, injuries to persons. That's the crimes we're dealing with here. It's not a foregone conclusion that they would be EJJ or certified as an adult. The courts would still have that review and that discretion. We're simply asking the committee and the legislature, it's time to review our juvenile justice system, criminal codes, and outcomes because of this great injustice. And I've also handed around a couple more articles that we found talking about the new age of social media and parents and gangs even recruiting their kids as young as 8 to be part of the gang activity. And gangs using Facebook and social medias nowadays to recruit younger and younger members. So I respectfully suggest it's time we get our arms around this and not let another family, any other parties and citizens of the state of Minnesota feel the injustice that the Johnsons have felt. So with that, I would like to have Lynn Johnson talk, give some background. With them, got a Fox 9 clip about Emily Johnson. Then Travis will talk a little more, and then I'd like to play the Carrie Levin clip regarding Michael Swanson.
Hey, thank you, Representative Westrom. And if you could have your testifier come up. Or good morning, ma'am. Good to have you here. Sorry I have to put you through this again, and hopefully we can come to some resolution on this time, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I've had plenty of practice at this.
You could state your name and first.
My name is Lynn Johnson, and I would first like to begin by thanking the committee for holding the hearing on Emily's Law and also for allowing us to testify here today. On June 16th, 2006, our lives changed forever. That morning, I dropped off our 2-year-old daughter, Emily Lynn Johnson, at her daycare provider's house. Little did I know that would be the last time I would see my daughter smile. Less than 8 hours later, I received a call from the provider that when she went to wake Emily up from her nap, Emily wouldn't wake up and she had called 911. I was in Fargo at the time, and while I rushed home, my mind raced. Did she have an allergic reaction? Why wouldn't she wake up? Did she fall and hit her head? Once I got to the ER, I realized the situation was much more serious than I could ever imagine. The next day at 8:59 p.m., we held our daughter as they removed her off of life support and took her last breath. In the days that followed, we learned that our daycare provider's 13-year-old son, who was 19 days away from his 14th birthday, had gone into the room where Emily was napping, sexually assaulted her, and then violently threw her against a wall. Emily laid there for another 2 hours while her brain was deprived of oxygen, which caused irreversible brain damage. During the weeks that followed, the nightmare continued. We were informed that the young man who did this to our daughter could not be punished or held accountable for his actions. He was too young. Our state doesn't allow our prosecutors to make a decision based solely on evidence and the seriousness of the crime. As the law currently stands, a person must be at least 14 years of age to even be considered to be tried as an adult. What makes this age a magical age? The person that assaulted and took the life of our daughter, as stated earlier, was just 19 days short of this date. Why is our daughter lying in the ground while our killer is allowed to continue on with his life with minimal interruptions? Something must change so that no other family has to feel the injustice we have felt from our justice system. The prosecutor in our case has stated that if she had the option, she would have strongly considered trying this person as an adult. We believe that our juvenile system, as it is today, is flawed and our laws are outdated. Let me first discuss the proposed legislation to lower the age that one can be tried as an adult after having committed a violent crime, especially murder. There are 13 states right now that have a minimum age of 13. In Kansas and Vermont, the age is 10. It's 14 in Indiana, but 10 for murder. In Missouri and Colorado, it's 12. It's 12 in Montana for murder. In Illinois, Mississippi, New Hampshire, North Carolina, and Wyoming, it's 13. It's 14 in New York, except for murder. Our proposed legislation would simply allow our prosecutors to look at each case individually and assess the mitigating factors before making the decision in which the court would try the case. Every case is different, and each should be treated individually. I do want to just mention the video that we are going to show kind of gives a synopsis of Emily and what we've gone through. This video was taken, this piece was done 2 years ago, So just keep that in mind when you're watching, but it is a great piece.
Thank you.
Killers can come in very small packages. An 11-year-old in Pennsylvania, an 8-year-old in Arizona, a 13-year-old right here in Minnesota. The states decide who can stand trial as an adult and who must stay in the juvenile system. In Minnesota, the magic age is 14. But one Minnesota family who has suffered the unimaginable says that must change.
What's your horse's name, Emily?
Doodada.
Doodada?
Yeah.
Can you go faster? Hey, should we send the ABCs?
How would you spend your time with her? What would you say to her?
What did I say, Z?
If you knew that soon, in say, just a couple of weeks, someone would take your baby girl away.
Bye-bye.
Travis and I. South Emily rocked her and sang to her and told her who to look for in heaven, and we just held her while she took her last breaths.
Of course, it's impossible to know that beforehand. So you take your baby girl to daycare, as you always do, and you go to work. And you think nothing of it until the daycare calls you.
And she basically said that she had gone down for a nap just fine, and she had slept longer than she normally does, so they went in to get her, and she was unresponsive.
This was 2-year-old Emily Johnson's daycare. The daycare provider left her teenage son in charge for a while that day.
She wasn't causing trouble. She wasn't, it wasn't an innocent punishment gone wrong. This young man went into her room she was napping in, took her out of the playpen she was in, and physically threw her against a wall.
What'd you get?
Cereal.
According to the Johnsons, who have a new baby, the boy confessed to killing Emily. It was only much later, after he'd pleaded guilty to a murder charge, that he admitted to something else.
Before he threw her. He did sexually assault her.
That was 3 years ago.
Most of this is clothes that she was wearing.
The Johnsons had made a quilt of Emily's clothing. It dominates their front entryway. And what of the boy? We found him at a Twin Cities high school. That's right, going to school in a public senior high next to an elementary school. All possible because of a state law that says anyone under 14 will be treated by the courts as a child.
At some point, we have to decide to treat kids like kids.
No matter how grown up the crime.
Our daycare provider's 13-year-old son had gone into Emily's room where she was napping, sexually assaulted her, and violently threw her against a wall.
And Emily Johnson's parents want that law changed.
Do you really believe that a 13-year-old doesn't know the difference between right and wrong?
Right now, 14-year-olds can be tried as adults and locked away. But the boy who killed Emily, her parents say, was just 19 days shy of his 14th birthday. The Johnsons want legislators to change the law and give prosecutors the discretion to try 13-year-olds as adults if they kill someone.
All we were asking is that the prosecutors would look at each case individually, and then they would decide if this young person should be charged as an adult.
Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum.
But the bill, called Emily's Law, is being blasted by those who work in the justice system.
What we try to do in the juvenile court, and unfortunately it's closed so people can't see us do it, we try to fix kids.
In February, Doug Johnson testified against the bill representing the County Attorneys Association. The state's prosecutors and public defenders opposed the bill, saying adult prison is no place for a 13-year-old.
Going to juvenile court is like going to the doctor. Let's say you have a skin rash. You go to the doctor, and the doctor gives you something for it. If it works, great. You don't go back. If it doesn't work, you try something else. And you keep trying something else.
But can you fix a 13-year-old who's murdered a 2-year-old girl?
I think so. Here's the other problem.
Have you ever seen it happen?
I haven't seen a 13-year-old murder a 2-year-old girl except this case.
The idea is to rehabilitate. So kids are put in what's called the least restrictive environment. They undergo psychological evaluation, treatment, and monitoring.
We just assume he would be punished. We didn't expect him to get life in prison. But we didn't expect him to be able to, in the first few months that summer, he was going on field trips in this boys' home he was living in.
For the Johnsons, it's not just that to them the punishment doesn't seem to fit the crime. It's that because the boy stayed in the juvenile court system, his crime will stay hidden to anyone he has contact with in the future. Juvenile court matters are secret. So at his new school, for example, his fellow students don't know what he's done. Even his principal and the assistant superintendent were surprised.
I don't think that there's a single family out there in Minnesota today that would want somebody that has committed such a violent crime, you know, sitting next to their daughter or their son or participating in extracurricular activities with their son or daughter, you know.
We can't know exactly what the terms of the teenager's sentence are, but according to his family, he's on parole, supervised 24 hours a day, and he had intensive therapy in a detention center for the past 2 years. And what the Johnsons find most alarming of all, when he turns 19, his juvenile record will be sealed.
He can work in a daycare. He can coach Little League baseball. He can drive a school bus. He can be a teacher. Anything that has to do with kids.
Minnesota is not alone in dealing with this issue. Arkansas changed its law and gave judges the option of making 13-year-olds stand trial as adults after a 13-year-old killed 4 students and a teacher in a school shooting. Minnesota has refused to follow suit, at least not yet.
With the exception of this one case, where has that policy failed us? This state has a really bad habit of reacting to one horrendous case.
But the Johnsons have a feeling their case will not be the last. And so when the law named for their little girl didn't even get out of committee this year, they promised not to give up.
So we're very determined. If it doesn't happen this year, we'll be back again next year, and the year after, and the year after.
So what if the boy who killed Emily had gone on trial as an adult? Depending on what he was convicted of, it's possible he'd be released even sooner and without treatment. If you want to read Emily's Law, go to myfox9.com and click on The Investigators. I'm Trish Van Pilsom for the Fox 9 Investigators.
Okay, Representative Westrom, how would you like to proceed now?
Mr. Chair, Travis, Emily's father would like to make some comments, and then we've got a shorter video from Carrie Levin we'd like to conclude. And I'll introduce that as soon as Travis is done.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir, and state your name first.
Mr. Chair, my name is Travis Johnson. Now, we have heard some of the opposition statements. One is that at the tender age of 13, one cannot tell the difference between right and wrong. Let's really think about that for a moment. How old were you when you started disciplining your children, started teaching them the difference between right and wrong? Pretty young, weren't they? And they understood, didn't they? Don't throw your food on the floor. Don't run with scissors. Don't throw sand at your brother. Don't hit your sister. Did you have a place for timeout for them? Do you really believe that even a young child doesn't know the difference between right and wrong? Then why do they lie to try to cover up or blame their sibling? It's because they are very much aware that they did something wrong. And this generally refers to petty things, not something as extreme as the beating that Emily took from the person who murdered her. Do you really believe that a 13-year-old doesn't know the difference between right and wrong? How many 13-year-olds do you know who have assaulted someone to the point of death? Imagine Emily, a defenseless 24-pound 2-year-old, left lying unconscious as he walked away when he so easily could have told an adult what he had done and attempted to get her medical attention. You will never convince me that the boy who was just 19 days short of being 14 years old didn't know what he was doing, while he was doing it, and then after he did it, was wrong. That's plain ludicrous, and I'll never believe that he didn't realize and that he didn't understand. He knew. The age needs to be lowered. Opponents argue that teens younger than 15 aren't psychologically mature enough to understand the consequences of their actions, that the human brain is not fully developed until the mid to late 20s. Maybe, I don't know. But why must the brain be fully developed for one to be held accountable for their actions? The mid to late 20s? How old are some of the soldiers we are sending to Iraq? At what age do we issue driving permits? We allow unsupervised driving of snowmobiles and ATVs at age 12. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources offers firearm safety training to youth beginning at age 11 that allows them to carry a weapon and hunt. I certainly hope their brains are adequately developed to warrant these responsibilities. With all these adult privileges available at such a young age, how then is it fair that when something goes wrong, as in Emily's situation, where her life was taken from her by the horrible, violent head trauma she received, that there is no accountability and there is no punishment? If kids are going to be given adult-like privileges, they should be given adult-like punishments. These kids are not kids anymore when they commit the intentional act of murder and should be treated as such. But again, I do not advocate them being incarcerated with adult offenders, but with juveniles of similar age. But they need to be punished. It's pretty hard to hear that Emily's perpetrator was seen at the zoo, at the local swimming pool, having more fun and participating in more activities. The age needs to be lowered. Now let's discuss the probation period of a juvenile offender. Currently, any juvenile who is placed on indefinite probation can be on probation only until their 19th birthday. Then on that day, the state of Minnesota loses jurisdiction and nobody is supervising them anymore. And yet we have heard that the brain is not fully developed until the mid to late 20s. Isn't that an interesting thought? If our goal is to complete rehabilitation and successfully re-entry into society, are we considering the best interest of a juvenile by abandoning them like we are? Doesn't this almost encourage reoffense? Doesn't this almost guarantee reoffense? It is the kids who most likely have abnormal behavior problems that are in the situation in the first place, so you certainly wouldn't think that they would be some of the first to have their fully developed brains. And yet the state of Minnesota has no choice but to abandon them when they turn 19. That seems irresponsible. As Minnesota law is currently written, the criminal record of a juvenile will be expunged at age 19. Poof. Any record of the crime magically disappears. I want to concentrate only on those with felony convictions, particularly murder. Think for a moment as a parent or a grandparent. Imagine that your child is at a summer camp and misbehaves. Let's say one of the counselors is a 21-year-old who loses his or her temper and strikes your child, causing life-threatening injuries. You find out only by chance that this same counselor, who as a 13-year-old was convicted of second-degree manslaughter for beating a 2-year-old, inflicting injuries to a point of death. But why didn't that show up during a background check? Why wasn't it disclosed on the employment application? It's because the 21-year-old's counselor's record was expunged at 19. Would you want him or her watching your child at daycare, coaching their Little League games? I would think that those first few years from age 19 until their brains are fully developed at the mid to late 20s are the most critical, and situations where reoffenses could occur should be avoided. Shouldn't the public be informed and have the right to make their own decisions and draw their own conclusions? Wouldn't we as adults be more conscientious if we monitored these offenders as they enter adulthood and make the transition into society? So what can be wrong with lowering the age at which a juvenile can be certified as an adult for violent crimes, especially murder? What could be wrong with giving our prosecutors the option to try a case as they feel would be the most appropriate? I absolutely do not advocate all cases being treated the same. And what can be wrong with keeping the felony conviction on the record? Our responsibility as adults is to protect our fellow human beings. Let's not lose sight of that responsibility. Let us also not find ourselves protecting juvenile criminals with more passion than we protect each other. We are all potential victims. We realize that this is a difficult subject to discuss, but it needs to be discussed and needs to be addressed now, and there is support out there for this law. God forbid that someone under the age of 14 walks into a school, kills some of their peers, teachers, and administrators. What then? Now is the time to be proactive instead of reactive. We live in the greatest country in the world, a democracy built around a system of checks and balances. You are not the court, however. You are not the judge. We have people that have been appointed into those positions. They have the facts and the evidence to make informed decisions. This proposed legislation will just give them another piece to use when needed. Give them the option to do what is right. We thank you for your time and would gladly answer any questions now or in the future if you ever have any.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. For the people that just brought the young children into the back, I'll leave it up to you whether you want to sit in this committee hearing or not, but some of this testimony could be fairly graphic, and we're talking about some serious adult things here, so it's up to you whether you want to have them stay. But okay, you wanted to show a video, Representative Westman?
Mr. Chair, I would. While John is getting it just loaded, let me just, I briefly touched on it, and then we'd be happy to answer, open it up to questions of the audience, or the committee members. The video is a clip from Carrie Levin, and the fresh crime of the Iowa murders is what I talked about in my introduction. And the idea that it just happened now, this clip will touch on this person has a troubled past as a juvenile and as a youth. And I might suggest to the committee that had he been tried as an adult or entered EJJ before age 14, we might not be hearing about two store clerks in Iowa that were just cold, calculated murders by a 17-year-old. And so I would just like to have members look at that and think about what we're asking for here is giving the option, as Travis talked about.
Okay.
What's that?
You mean this giant check? $522.
What's that? It's loading. Okay. It's loading, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Good evening. Authorities say one of the victims was a 47-year-old mother of 11 children, ranging in age from 4 to 27.
17-year-old Michael Swanson of St. Louis Park has been charged as an adult with two counts each of first-degree murder and first-degree robbery. Here's video from the Des Moines Register of Swanson this afternoon. He is smiling, as you can see, and laughing as he's led from the Kossuth County Jail to the courthouse. Authorities in Iowa say Swanson went into gas stations in Algona and Humboldt last night, robbed the stores, and then shot and killed the clerks. 11 Scott Soroka has more.
180 miles separate St. Louis Park from Algona, Iowa. Police say they have no idea why a teen from the Twin Cities metro area was in central Iowa last night.
You always hear this happening in the bigger cities, never small town Algona, you know. It's really hard when it hits home.
The first shooting occurred at 9 o'clock Monday night. Investigators say 17-year-old Michael Swanson walked into the Senex station in Algona, Iowa, in a ski mask, demanded cash and cigarettes. The clerk complied. Authorities say 47-year-old Vicki Bowman Hall, a mother of 11, was shot and killed anyway. An hour later, 30 miles south, a 61-year-old store clerk was shot and killed. Swanson is charged in both murders.
He's my neighbor.
Folks who live near the home Swanson grew up in say they haven't seen the teen for a while.
I mean, this is a little much to take right away.
We've learned after an auto theft conviction, he spent time at the Hennepin County Home School. He was released on November 5th, got 2 years probation. On Monday, Hennepin County authorities said he took a car and a debit card from his home and took...
If you have the audacity to...
Mr. Chair, the video got preempted by a pop-up, I understand.
All right.
The ending...
Maybe you can scroll ahead possibly to that where we left.
There we go.
Yep.
Forward.
Yep.
Authorities said he took a car and a debit card from his home and took off. A warrant went out for his arrest. He was arrested for two murders a day and a half later around midnight at a McDonald's in Iowa.
He was just a typical kid growing up. I wouldn't think this of him.
The head of the neighborhood watch says she's been worried about him since he was a preteen. Michael Swanson, seen here in a St. Louis Park High School photo, has assembled a lengthy criminal record, including theft and assault, by the time he had turned 13.
Here live, Swanson returned to this home after he was released from a juvenile facility last week. He enrolled into St. Louis Park High School right away. Authorities believe he stole his parents' truck Sunday and then stole a gun from their cabin up north. Again, Michael Swanson was arrested late last night. This afternoon, a judge ordered a...
Mr. Chair, members, I hope you understand the same concern for our current system and the injustice that occurred just because somebody was 19 days from turning 14. I think many people would say that's injustice. If this bill isn't exactly right, I implore us as a legislature to come up with a better system that's going to not treat treat those that are 14 and older that commit a violent felony crime so much different than somebody who's 13, and have them feel the injustice that the Johnsons have. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to entertain questions, or I know you've got further witnesses that want to testify.
Is there any other, before we get to Representative Grunhagen's question, is there any other testifiers in support, or is this it?
That's it for us, Mr. Okay. Chair.
We'll get to Representative Grunhagen's question in a minute here, but before the opposition comes up, keep in mind that while you worry about little Johnny going off to prison or something bad happening to him, or worry about the rest of his life, keep in mind that little Emily is dead, okay? And don't come up here year after year offering no solutions, just worrying about little Johnny and what happens to him. Worry about Emily, too. Please give us something concrete that we can build upon. Don't just come up and say, we can't do this, we can't do this. I see probation, I see county attorneys, I see public defense out here. We certainly have the people here to work on it. It's my intention, so you know I can't speak for my committee, but it's my intention to move this bill forward, not to let it die again in committee and just be laid over. It's my intention to bring it up and get it up and get a vote and get it resolved. So please bring some solutions with your testimony today and some ideas, and work with the parents and Representative Nornes and Westrom on this. And then Representative Grunhagen, your question?
Mr. Chair, testifiers, Representative Westrom, I just have a couple of observations I'd like to make after watching the testimony. First thing, I'm a freshman, and it's first time on this committee, but I take my responsibility here very seriously, and I'm honored to be on a committee like this. But one of the things, symbols, I have constantly remind myself on a committee that deals with the judiciary, is the lady with the blindfold
and two scales. What that symbol tells me, and it's the ideal I ascribe to, that the blindfold shows that regardless of social status financially, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of any other circumstances, people should be treated equally based on the facts, okay? And that's what I ascribe to personally. The other observation I'd like to make in relationship to this case is that it saddens me to see where our society is headed. As we've seen by some of the reporting, the heinous crimes occurring in our state and nation seem to be going to a lower and lower level of children. And I believe, personally, and I like to speak to every adult here, that one of the reasons this is happening is we have moved away from the concept of limited liberty, which this country was founded on, from a creator and his moral absolutes, to licentious freedom, where adults used to limit their desires and things that they wanted to do based on what's good for children and our society as a general. Today, we have embraced licentious liberty. And now we have purveyors of filth and perversion, both in videos, movies, and every other way in our culture, that go after our children and pervert and destroy them at a very young age. Now, to the degree that that was responsible for the crime we're talking about here, I'm not sure. But it permeates our society. So until we as adults come to the recognition that our liberty comes as a preamble of the Constitution of the Minnesota states, and I memorized it, it says, we the people of the state of Minnesota, grateful to God for our civil and religious liberties, and desiring its blessings and to perpetuate those blessings to ourselves and our children, do hereby establish and ordain this Constitution. When your liberties come from a creator, you limit your behavior as an adult for the good of children and our society. We have embraced licentious freedom, and we're seeing the results of that right here in front of us today. So all of us, let's return our countries to the principles it was founded on. Finally, in relationship to the bill, it saddens me that we need to do this, but when I look at it, it allows the court to make the discretion. I personally believe that with licentious freedom, being the type of freedom we embrace here in this country, that these types of laws are necessary, because we're only going to see more and more and more of it as we corrupt our children with our own licentious freedom. Thank you for giving me that opportunity to share that.
Representative McDonald, we can hold the applause down, please. Otherwise,
Chairman,
we'll do it for everybody. Representative McDonald, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had to.
Yes,
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, I've been here 14 years, and we haven't allowed this kind of thing from either party on the in committee, and I'm just wondering if this is going to open up to kind of getting away with the type of committees we've always had going on.
Allowing what you're talking about?
Well, speeches like that, clapping, different things like that. We haven't done that in my 14 years from your side or my side. And
well, I understand your comment in one way, where you must have been at a different legislature than I have, because we get a lot more speeches than that on a lot of different subjects, very emotional. But on the applause, I did say that we have to hold the applause down, and we shouldn't do that. Otherwise, every time that somebody makes a speech that somebody's in favor of, we're going to be interrupted with applause. But we don't stifle anybody from making a speech, how emotional they are. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, I just like to say that my heart and my soul go out to you and the loss of your daughter, Emily. Because I know since I heard of this bill, my heart has become very, very heavy. As a mother of seven children, who have raised seven children, this becomes really difficult when we begin to see our children as adults. I just saw a whole group of young people come in, and I say some of them may be about 10 years old, and at no way, at no time, and I do understand your hurt and your pain, that we can look at, in my opinion, a 14-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 10-year-old baby as an adult, and think that at any time that we can see them other than, anything other than, a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old. We have many people around this table who are parents and hopefully have had a chance to raise your kids and see them grow and develop. And as we have watched them grow and develop, your own child, your own baby, I know at no time have you ever been able to see them as a 10-year-old, as an adult, as an 11-year-old, as an adult, as a 12 or 13-year-old, as an adult. They don't have the capacity to think and function as an adult, developmentally, cognitively. They don't have the capacity. Yes, there are consequences, and we all have to have consequences for our actions. But to see a child as an adult is a failure on our part as adults. We, as adults, and I heard it several times, come to say, as I wrote down, that, and the video, go back to the video, was a 17-year-old. And what I heard within that video is stated that at 13 he began to get in trouble. And I say again, we have failed that child at 13 to treat him, to give him what he needs so that he can be a productive citizen. If we don't start early with our kids to do what we need to do with our kids, they will find ways to be in trouble. And we have to set a standard here about how we are going to support our young people so that they can grow up to be productive young men and women. We have failed them, and we cannot prosecute and blame them for their behavior. And of course, yes, we do have to have consequences for their actions, but we also have to treat them. We have to, there's definitely something that is going on that is not right, and we have to find and give them the services that they need so that a child at 13 is not finding themselves at 17 on a spree of killing. So we as adults need to look at our criminal justice system and how it's going to support our community, how it will support our young people, how we're going to provide them with the services and the support and the compassion that they need because they are kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryan. Any other questions before we move on to the next testifiers?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Western.
If I could just respond to that.
Go ahead.
I think some of that I would agree. Well, a lot of it I would agree. But I think the bottom line message is, Representative, is the problem is there's a problem with our current system. Obviously. Now, I don't subscribe to the notion that they should walk as light a sentence as what's happened here. But they can't even get in the EJJ system and receive a punishment with an adult sentence hanging over their head if they're under 14. And that's some of what we're trying to change. But I appreciate your comments because I take it that you understand there's a problem with the current system. And the outcome might be different, what you're subscribing to, than what we're subscribing to or suggesting. But I think the message is there is a problem in the current system. At 13, somebody that goes on a spree at 17 is a classic example of they needed more intervention and more punishment early on than what they've received in our current system.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, Representative Moran, and then Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by no means am I saying that. I just want to take the adult sentencing part out of there because, again, I believe we have an opportunity here. We have an opportunity with our kids to provide them with the services that they need so that when they are adults, they have a chance to be productive citizens. And when we do not give them the services, the intervention, and the prevention that they need as young people, we set them up for, and sometimes, to have unhealthy behaviors later on in life. So it's up to us as adults. It's up to us to do that and to set the standards as to where we're going to go in the 21st century, going forward. Where is our responsibility to our kids? Because we are failing our kids.
Thank you. Representative Slocum, and then Representative Liger, followed by Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say to you that my heart aches as a mom and as a teacher. And I've spent 25 years teaching 13 and 14-year-olds. And I know their capabilities. And I think I've even voted for this before. But one of the things that I'm looking at on a sheet that was at my seat is Emily's Law, and it has bullet points. The last bullet point says some states do not set a minimum age but have other criteria for determining whether a child may be sentenced in adult court. It seems to me, I read everything that goes in front of me, but it seems to me that just lowering the age to 13 is it's a band-aid on a system that needs reform. We're talking about reform here. I would love to work with Representative Westrum and look at the juvenile justice system, and let's look at not a minimum age, but criteria as to whether the crime deserves to, and the person who committed it, whether they're 13, 14, 17, whether that person should be tried as an adult or not. Let's look at the system. The system seems broken, as opposed to one law for one case, which is a horrendous case and just makes my heart ache. But we need to look at real reform, which deals with the juvenile justice system.
Representative Westburn.
Ms. Johnson would like to reply or comment, if that's all right.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to clarify, just for my husband and I, for some of the freshman representatives, this is our fifth year that we've tried to get something passed. And each year, we have asked for people to work with us. Representative Mullery, you know that. We have asked for help to revamp this juvenile system that failed us miserably. This is the only way we can get your attention. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me we've gotten some attention today with a 10-year-old age. We want to work with the legislatures. We don't expect it to be 10. We understand that we don't want it to be a Band-Aid. You know, so we want to work with you guys and make the system work for our children and for us as members of society so we can feel safe. I just wanted to...
We'll take Representative Liger and then Mullery, and then we'd like to move off to questions and into testimony next, if we could, please. Representative Liger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to try to be brief. Just picking up on Representative Moore and Moran's comments, and I have a question. Now, the way I heard that one video was that the fellow who did the crimes down in Iowa, he had an extensive record by the age of 13. I think that's what they were saying. It wasn't that it had all started at the age of 13. That he had a documented history. And they didn't go beyond that, but I'm only going to assume maybe that a lot of that was in the courts, and that was and the information was available to prosecutors. My question is, in this case, and I realize you've been doing this a long time. I'm new. I don't know that much about it. I really don't want to belabor this, but I think it's important for a lot of the new members to know. In this case, was this perpetrator, did he have a long history prior to this incident?
Anyone could answer there if you would like. Identify yourself.
from what we've learned, Lynn Johnson, no, he did not. He was very sneaky. He knew what he was doing. I can tell you that this was not the first instance that he hurt a child, but he knew what he was doing, and he never was caught prior until after he killed our daughter.
Thank you. That I just want to put that in perspective, that's all. Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, I think, yes, you've worked on this. I've been working on juvenile justice reform for several years and haven't gotten anywhere very far with the legislature. And I want to thank the Chair Cornish for agreeing, I believe it's next week, to have a hearing on the new juvenile justice reform and the science and research that's been out there. I'm on the 13-member youth advisory board for the National Conference of State Legislatures, and one of our biggest issues is the fact that juvenile justice reform is only being bought into by a few states to look at what we really need. And this is a really serious issue, and if we don't start treating it, but it requires a lot of work. It requires mere incarceration is a 10-year-old kid isn't going to think about, yeah, if I do something, I'm going to be in prison for life. There's a lot of research, including by a expert at Harvard who is a scientist, used to be at the University of Minnesota, and I worked with him when he was here, on the fact that the brain, that part of the judgment section, the prefrontal cortex of the brain, just starts growing at age 8, and most of the growth is between 8 and 18, so a 10-year-old is barely, that part of the brain's just starting to grow. We really need to have a lot more services for juvenile court, for children in need of protection, a lot more looking into their mental health. Right now we have very little effort into seeing when youth are starting to exhibit signs of it and following through on it. So I think this is, as you said, Representative Westrom, a serious issue, and it's about time the legislature starts looking at it. But a kind of a knee-jerk reaction is now what's needed. We really have to get into this. And I thank Chair Cornish for having a hearing to explain briefly some of the things that are going on nationally on this with research and things like that.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Thank you for holding questions, members. And Representative Westrom, any more comment, or can we move up?
No, Mr. Chair, I think we're done. Move to other testimony. That would be fine.
And thank you for the Johnson family for preparing.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, Mr. Kingery and Mr. Stewart, do you want to come up together or separate? You can choose whoever, which one wants to go first. State your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Representative Nornes, go ahead.
I just wanted to make sure that there is time at the end in case, following this testimony, the Johnsons would like to have a chance to answer or clarify.
Okay,
so that
Representative
they may have the last word.
Try to keep a spot open at the end for me, Bet. Okay, folks, go ahead. State your name and title, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name's John Stewart. I'm the Minnesota State Public Defender. I've been working with at-risk juveniles now since 1968, and I was a member of the task force from 1992 to 94 that studied the juvenile court and drafted the bill that you later enacted that we call the EJJ law. I must say there's just no room for denial that this is a heartbreaking, shocking crime that we've all heard about here today. I do want to say, though, that juvenile court has been operating in Minnesota since 1905, and it has had tremendous success with thousands of kids who have committed very serious crimes. So I believe juvenile court deserves substantial consideration, and I'm glad that this committee is going to do that and not immediately institute an extreme makeover. I'd be glad to cooperate and participate in any way that I could help this committee deal with juvenile justice issues. I want to just take a minute, though, and talk about the question of how Minnesota with teenage offenders, what the strategy is to get the most public safety in the long run. Because in the situation of many of the violent crimes that are listed in the list of violent crimes in this bill, the juvenile court actually has more power over the offender than the adult court would. Now, people think, well, you send them to adult court and adult court will take care of it. But really, adult court is governed by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. There are four offenses that are in the list of violent offenses here where if you took all those kids and sent them to adult court, the adult court sentence would be probation. So that's something to think about. Another set of four of the offenses that are listed here, the adult court sentence under the sentencing guidelines, and there's a chart, I know many of you are familiar with this grid, this is the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, there's four crimes here where the adult sentence would be 48 months, of which 32 months would be served in prison, and then 16 months would be on supervision, and then the individual would be completely off supervision and out of prison and walking around free because they would have done their time, as we say. So, for instance, take aggravated robbery is on this list. That's a 48-month crime. You get your 12-year-old who commits an aggravated robbery. We say, well, we're going to take care of this by sending him to adult court, and this sounds plausible. He's going to serve 32 months. Now your 12-year-old is going to be 15, and they've completed the prison part of their sentence. They can be supervised until maybe they're 16 and a half, and then they are done. Or in this terrible crime that we've heard about today, this juvenile was convicted of second-degree manslaughter. That's another crime where the adult sentence is 48 months. So you take your 10 or 11 or 13-year-old or whatever, they do 32 months in prison, then they're supervised for 16 months, and they're done. Meanwhile, the juvenile court has got the power, even without the EJJ provision, to keep that juvenile under control until age 19. So in some of these situations, you would end up sending to adult court. The result would be you would have a 16-year-old who had spent all of their junior high school years in prison, and now they're out, and they've served their sentence, and they're done, whereas the juvenile court could keep them under control until age 19. So there are some things that juvenile court can do for public safety, and there are some things that adult court can do for public safety. And as you think about those two concepts together, as I say, I'd be glad to be of any help that I possibly could.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. In the cases you talked about, would the juvenile's records or names be public, or would that still be private data?
Mr. Chair, presently 16-year-olds with felonies, that's all public. But if the juvenile is certified to adult court, that would become public also. I mean, for one thing, the juvenile and adult court would have a jury trial. So it would be an open court and it would be a trial by jury.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grothier, you have a question.
Chairman Cornish, I would like to wait till after testimony, if I could.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You use the phrase juvenile court would, quote, keep them under control, unquote. Just what do you mean by that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, well, they'd be under supervision and the court would have the power to send them to a more secure placement up to the age of 19. For instance, I had a kid who was on probation at 14 for stealing a dog collar out of a pet store. And he was supposed to show up and do community service, and he didn't. And he ended up in the community, in the Hennepin County homeschool. And he messed up there, and he got sent to Red Wing. And each time he would go back to juvenile court, and the juvenile court judge basically had review over that kid until he was age 19. And if he would mess up, then there would be a more serious consequence put into place. So I'm talking about jurisdiction, supervision, probation, dispositional reviews up until the age of 19.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up question. So let me ask a follow-up in plain English. When someone goes through adult court and they wind up in prison, they are prevented from killing anyone else on the street for the time they're in prison, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, then if someone goes through juvenile court and is, quote, under control, unquote, does that mean they could, in all circumstances, be prevented from killing someone else while they're, quote, under control, unquote?
Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chairman, I'd like a yes or no first, and then you can fill it in.
Mr. Stewart?
I'd have to honestly say no, you can't stop them from killing somebody. But you could put them in Red Wing, where they're behind that big fence. It's a secure facility. Perhaps they would kill a person working or another resident at Red Wing. I don't know. I mean, ultimately, the power to keep somebody from killing somebody else, we don't have that power completely.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith.
So then, when one is gone through adult court and in prison, they are kept away entirely from law-abiding members of society and therefore would be unable to kill them. But if they go through juvenile court and wind up, quote, under their control, unquote, that is not the case. Is that correct, yes or no?
Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'm really not sure if the answer is yes or no here. The juvenile court, I would agree with you, cannot keep them from killing somebody. On the other hand, the adult court could put them in prison for 32 months, and then they'd be out. So there's the immediate, what are they going to be doing for that 32 months? And then there's the question of what are they going to be like as a risk to the public when they're 18, 19, 20, 25 years old.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a quick follow-up to Representative Smith's questioning, in this case, Emily Johnson's murderer, according to the video we just saw, was in high school. Is that the kind of supervision we're talking about in the juvenile justice system?
Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be individualized in some situations that, you know, the last time I took a tour of Red Wing, they had five kids there that had committed homicides. And they weren't in a public high school. They were behind the big fence at Red Wing. So it's the court is looking at each of these cases one at a time.
Okay, just a quick follow-up that. Too. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would think certainly that Minnesotans would expect this is such a heinous crime that if the juvenile justice system was taking care of it, this would be one of those cases where they would not be in high school and be with the other five in Red Wing. That's very concerning, and I certainly appreciate Representative Nornes and Representative Westrom bringing this this bill again before this body, and I look forward to further testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, to that point.
Representative Mulroney, sorry, but I got your name here.
Just real quick, wouldn't my understanding is that if he was charged as an adult and sentenced as an adult, he would be in high school right now and not under supervision.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, yes, that's true, because his 32 months would be over, right, and he'd be back in the community if he were in adult court.
Right.
What do you have? Representative Moran, followed by Representative Schleidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is, and again, I'm just going to convert back to our juvenile justice system, because I hear a lot about incarceration. I hear that they're under control. I hear that they're under supervision. But I don't hear treatment. So what is going on? Does anything go on different in a juvenile detention center than in an adult center prison? One question. And then the other half is, if a child goes into an adult prison system, what is the likelihood that they themselves may be killed?
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you've put your finger on how juvenile court has been successful with juveniles who have committed serious offenses for 100 and some years. They do provide treatment, and very, very often successful. The last time I was at St. Cloud Prison, they had four counselors for about 1,000 people that were in there. So treatment is not the major thing that people are in St. Cloud Prison for. But in the juvenile system, that's the first thing you think about, because the concern is, what can we do so that this doesn't happen again?
Representative Moran.
So what I'm hearing is that you're thinking more in long-term, the outcome, than a short-term punishment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, yes.
Mr. Stewart, just a philosophical question. What right do the parents of Emily have after being sexually molested and thrown against a wall as far as their right to punishment? Do they have any degree of certainty for punishment, not just a treatment phase, but don't they have to receive some justification in some punishment of this offender?
Mr. Chair, the juvenile court judge has a lot of options. The juvenile, and I must say, I haven't got this file. I'm not knowledgeable of what the juvenile court judge knew who was dealing with this case, but she or he could have said, all right, you're going to go to Red Wing and you're going to be in the secure cottage behind the fence in a locked cell until you're 19 years old. I mean, that would have been a possible outcome, but they're working to try to carry out the judicial process to figure out the best outcome for society in the long run. And, you know, it's easy for us to go, golly. Is that what happened here? But like I say, I'm not the judge. I'm not sitting there with all the reports from the people that examined this young man.
Okay.
All I can say is that in our system, the judge would make that call.
The reason I ask the question is it's, and I apologize to members for being so graphic, I'm bringing up a point about Emily being dead and then about thrown against the wall, but sometimes when we consider this, we think of our fancy psychological studies and what's going to happen to poor Johnny, and we lose the context of this crime has happened and the right to the parents to have some result in punishment. And so, and you just kind of wonder, all those faces sitting out here in the crowd that are here to champion the cause of poor Johnny being sent to prison, what if they come home and find their daughter in this? How would that affect their outlook on what should happen. And so it's just kind of once in a while I want to bring this back to the crime, and instead of talking about juvenile justice, which we're going to talk about sooner or later, but just to bring the seriousness back an issue. Representative, did we take care of Leidiger? Here we go.
Sir, I wanted to follow up on Representative Wooder's line of questioning. You know, if we would have gone the adult system, this particular case, this is a sexual crime as well. There would have been opportunity once he'd done the. First of all, he would have had a record, be gone through the adult system, and secondly, he could have been sent to St. Peter to do training there. We just learned about that, where we send our sexual deviants. And that's where a lot of the correctional and education is being done for that population. So I see, and probably most importantly, the public would know about this. That it would be out there in the public domain, and we'd be aware that that he exists in the population once he's let out, as opposed to what's happening now. We don't know where this kid is.
Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding from the previous testimony was that he was convicted of manslaughter in the second degree. And so I've been talking about the case based on what he was convicted of. Certainly, it would have been possible to commit him as a sexually dangerous person, and he could be in St. Peter or Moose Lake right now. But again, that's a judicial determination. The county attorney would bring a petition. They can bring a petition against a juvenile and have a juvenile committed to one of those facilities if they feel that that's in the interest of public safety.
Representative Leger?
Well, I think that's what the bill's all about. I mean, this can be, if we lower the age, it can be determined to go that particular route. Am I correct? They can go the adult route.
Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, the sexual offender commitment is in another chapter of the laws. That's not in this bill. But it's being done already. I mean, there is the power already in law to send a juvenile into the St. Peter or Moose Lake program.
And hopefully any treatment that we give these offenders will have a lot better luck than the sex offender program that's gone for a decade and hasn't graduated one person. Representative Keither, Gauthier, and Johnson, I should be mindful, I've been taking up just as much time as anybody or more, but we've got four testifiers left, and the family wants to finish with a comment,
Mr.
and we've got
Chair.
25 minutes left. So, Mr. Representative
Chair,
Keither first.
Could I just ask a question on process?
Okay.
The reason I deferred is I was hoping that we could get our testifiers in before we started debate and discussion and questions, and I would just like to know if that's your intent, that we're going to continue to interrupt testifiers, or if we're going to wait until they're done.
Well, Representative Gauthier, good.
Because if we're going to interrupt, then I would like to have my time.
Good point. I don't call it, however, an interruption. It's just questioning, but at any rate, Representatives Keith or Gauthier Johnson, would you mind holding until we have the opposition come up or finish the testifying, and then we'll go down the list? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I first want to say that I'm blessed to be the father of two children, and I can't imagine the pain that these parents have gone through. Having seen their young daughter, the victim of this horrific crime, my heart goes out to them, and I wish them the best as they move forward. What you have before you is a position paper that was developed by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. This bill has gone through different variations over the last 4 or 5 years, and we've had different position papers on it. The one before you is drafted to the more narrow bill that was considered by this committee previously. We do believe that the current bill before you is too expansive. Too many crimes are covered by it, The age is too low. We're talking about 10-year-olds here. If you're going to do something in this area, we strongly encourage you to narrow the number of crimes that are covered by this and that the age be slightly older if you are going to do that. But that being said, I'll just make a couple of very brief comments. We certainly all agree that public safety must be a central consideration in the handling of all juvenile delinquency cases. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the juvenile justice system must continue to recognize the unique nature of juvenile offenders and the need for consequences beyond simple removal from society for a set period of time. The juvenile justice system, as you'll learn next week, was created to provide consequences and change the behavior of juvenile offenders. The consequences are designed to fix the child rather than simply warehouse him or her. I spoke to one of our most skilled juvenile prosecutors in preparation for today's hearing. She's also the former chair of our juvenile law committee. And she stated that the feet of some of the young juveniles she has handled don't even touch the floor. We're talking about very, very young children. It was her view that kids change dramatically during their teen years and that the juvenile system is designed to offer the array of services that they need, but so by the time they reach adulthood, many are fully capable and law-abiding citizens. Also, we've done some review in this area, and we have not been able to find any case in which a 13-year-old charged with murder and committed to the juvenile justice system committed another murder later in life. Committing a violent 13-year-old to the juvenile justice system, we believe, is consistent with public safety as well as rehabilitation. And I would simply conclude, and I think you've heard some folks mention it here this morning, that many practitioners have observed that the mental health issues facing troubled youth, they've observed that, they've identified that, and they support options that would increase the resources for diagnosis, treatment, and general health services. And we support that effort. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a quick comment, Mr. Chair, about process as well. I felt a little bit uncomfortable. I know we all have election certificates. We can say what we want, but I felt uncomfortable with some of the comments you made with respect to the public that's out here to participate. They might have a different opinion on some of these issues, and it doesn't mean that we're wrong or they're wrong or we're right, they're right. This is a very complicated and emotional issue, and I think they should be given their due respect. I haven't felt that necessarily being the case, so that's just a comment.
All right. Please knock off the clapping. Everybody, each side has had their own time for the clapping.
And I don't mean any disrespect to you, Mr. Chair, but that's just my observation. But I do have a question for the
testifier. Representative Johnson, that's why I started out by asking anybody out there wanted, we'd put them on the list if they have opposition and give them their voice, but go ahead.
To the testifier, one concern I have is that we seem to get the sense that there's been a spike or an incredible rise in violent juvenile crime throughout the state. And, you know, if that's the case, then that really gives an impetus for moving forward on some of these important issues. And the tragedy that we've had discussed before is indeed horrible and incredibly sad. But what I do want to know is there an increase, is there a spike in these violent juvenile crimes that is requiring some tough response at this point in time? I just don't have a sense of that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not aware of a spike. There may be, but I'm not aware of it. I think the few individual cases we see have been publicized, so those small numbers may lead you to believe that there's an increase, but I'm not aware of a spike in violent juvenile crime.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, juvenile crime in Minnesota has been going down, and violent juvenile crime has been going down, and I'm mighty glad. But that doesn't mean that there won't be a shocking, heartbreaking case such as we've heard about today. On the whole, though, the trend has been
down. Thank
you. Representative Kiefer?
Yes, thank you. I just I understand there wasn't a record in this particular case before the crime occurred. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer.
I'm going back to the original.
Right. I'm just going by the testimony that I've heard. I don't have the record, but I understand that there was no prior offense from what we've heard this morning.
I'm just wondering, because I know that juvenile records are kind of kept secret, and let's just say this is a totally different case, and there's a youngster with a problem in a record. If that family was running a daycare or something, how do we protect that the customers of the daycare or the school or the preschool? Are you allowed to share that data with the customers? Just, you know, obviously to avoid potential problems in the future.
Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, I believe that Human Services licenses the person who would have been the parent of the perpetrator in this case, and they don't necessarily know, particularly if the license holder's kids don't have any record, they don't necessarily know that there's a dangerous kid who's attached to the person who holds the license. And it might be that you could do something about that licensing procedure, but you would still have to have the individual have a track record that would affect the license.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Keith?
Representative Franson, who's also interested in this bill, a co-author, and ran a daycare prior to her election, just gave me the information that the county would be aware of the information on 13 and over when they're licensing their daycare, Representative Keeper. So we can follow up a little more information on that, but that's what Representative Franson just informed me of.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to move on into the next. Thank you very much, gentlemen. The next testifier, and would it be Michael Belton, Ramsey County Corrections?
Where's that?
Okay, gentlemen, whoever wants to can start and give your name and title. And
Mr. Chair, my name is, and committee members, my name is Michael Belton, and I'm employed as the Deputy Director for Ramsey County Juvenile Corrections. I'm speaking this morning on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, or MAC Act. As you know, MAC Act is an organization comprised of 32 counties from across the state. Its membership runs the gamut from large metropolitan counties to smaller counties in greater Minnesota. MAC Act is generally in support of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association's position, which opposes this proposed legislation. Research tells us that this type of legislation does not deter crime, it aggravates recidivism, and compromises public safety. We in community corrections work tirelessly every day to promote public safety. For us, public safety is one of the paramount tenets of our work. It is therefore no surprise that we are horrified and deeply saddened by the circumstances that bring us here today to consider the legislative matter on the table. The traumatic horror visited upon victims and their surviving families resulting from such violence is unspeakable in nature. All of us are moved by the ineffable tragedies that these violent acts leave in their wake. It is our view that juvenile court has the range and capacity to supervise the very young children who commit violent offenses. A youth committing a violent crime at age 10 could be supervised until their 19th birthday within the juvenile system. Further, they could be committed through civil court proceedings for ongoing mental health treatment at age 18 if necessary. The juvenile court has a long-term residential facilities at both the local and state levels, particularly the correctional facility at Red Wing, which is operated by the State Commissioner of Corrections, at its disposal. The juvenile court has the mandate to both hold youth accountable for their offenses and to provide services that promote pro-social behavior. We agree with the County Attorneys Association that while extraordinarily tragic, the incidences where young children commit extremely violent acts are still very rare in this state. Our position is that a change in law is simply unnecessary. Sentencing a 10, 11, 12, or 13-year-old child to an adult prison is a short-term response that tends to compromise long-term public safety interests. The UCLA Law School Juvenile Justice Project 2010 report refers to a compilation of statistics from 15 states indicating that juveniles released from adult prisons are rearrested at a significantly higher rate than their adult counterparts. The same report cited Minnesota youth tried as adults as being 16% more likely than their peers tried in juvenile court to reoffend within 2 years of release. The point is that sentencing a child to an adult prison has a negative impact on their ability to safely rejoin society. My first job in corrections was that of a guard at the Minnesota Reformatory in St. Cloud. At that time, 40 years ago, there was one 14-year-old youth serving a very long sentence for a very serious crime. It was my firsthand observation that a youth held in an adult prison gets an overwhelming number of adult criminals as his teacher. This occurs at a highly impressionable age. Compounding this reality is the fact that in most cases, a youth sentenced as an adult will be released from prison at a fairly young age. A 10-year-old sentenced to 98 months, which is the high national average for youth committing a violent offense, would be released around his 18th birthday. In sum, it is our position that this proposed legislation would present a serious compromise to long-term public safety. In the final analysis, it does not reverse or prevent the tragic loss generated by these still extremely rare but devastating violent acts. Moreover, by consigning very young children who commit these unspeakable acts to adult prisons, the legislation will have the unintended consequence of paving the way for future criminal behavior. On behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act, I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, sir. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Chairman Cornish. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, I know that all of us can't imagine what you're going through, and I... my sincere condolences. I also would like to applaud you on your courage for continuing to come here and to bring an important issue before the legislature with Representative Westrom. I think what I heard you say was that the motivation was to open a discussion, and I think you've done that today, and I want to commit to you that as long as I sit on this committee, that we'll look at reform for juvenile justice and work with our colleagues on both sides of the aisle. The other thing, I think the colleagues on my side of the table would say that I'm probably not as liberal on crime as they are. But I have to say in this situation, having worked 27 years with adults and kids, to adjudicate a 10-year-old as an adult and to put them into a correctional facility just doesn't make sense. What we are really dealing here with is a failure of either family and community, because I believe that we are all responsible for our children. And something went terribly awry. And no matter how much and how hard we try, we will have another horrific incident. I don't think we can stop them all, and we will never ever know how many we have stopped. I also believe in my faith in redemption. And I can tell you in 27 years, I have watched kids that I thought were just hopeless of turning anything around becoming productive citizens to our society. I had one yesterday, or the other day when I was back home in Duluth, come up to me. I worked with him when he was 15 years old. He's an Iraqi veteran. And what he said to me is, Kerry, I never told you this, but you hung in there when nobody else would, and you changed my life. It took me a few tries, but you changed it. And I think there are thousands of providers in this state that give their all to help our children. And we need to believe in redemption. I don't know if this young man has found redemption or not. But what I do believe is that we do need to take a look at the juvenile justice system. I do believe that we need to have a legislative commission on juvenile justice, and I'm hoping that the speaker and the majority party would agree to that and take a look at those things. But we all need to take responsibility in what happened here. It was a failure of our community and our society. And I know when I was growing up, and I don't think it happens much today, but if I was doing something wrong, I wasn't thinking about what I was doing wrong, but if the neighbors saw me, I heard about it, and then I heard about it when I got home. Because we believed in taking care of each other in our neighborhood. And I think that's part of what we need to do. And having said that, then we need to look at the juvenile justice system as part of that community and how we take care of our kids and how we rehabilitate them. And I'm not under the illusion that they will all be rehabilitated. But I do know an adult correctional facility, the mission is to keep society safe from those who commit violent crimes. It is not about rehabilitation. And we cannot put children in those situations.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes left to get your testimony in, two more testimonies, and the family. So I don't know how we're going to do that because we should adjourn at noon unless people want to stay late over their lunch hour. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Cornish, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Calvin Sari, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Corrections Association. Minnesota Corrections Association is an organization just as MACAC, which Mr. Belton has talked about, and many others that are in there. Our association is broad in its scope. We represent the corrections professionals, those working in the field, not only probation and parole officers in the field, but those in the institutions, those that are providing treatment services, and the vendors that provide various services within. So we're a large, large organization, and really our people do the research, are doing the day-to-day work, and are doing the research on what is best practices and evidence-based practices in the state of Minnesota. I had about a 10-minute presentation prepared to make to you today with a lot of statistics that are based pretty much on the same conversations you've had today, but I think I can abbreviate my comments with this. I have already presented to each one of you as a member of the committee a document in your office, or I've talked to you personally already about this document, which is entitled the Minnesota Corrections Association 2011 Legislative Agenda. This is something that our association does every year, and we pick the hot buttons, and we propose position papers or print position papers for the benefit of the legislature on an annual basis. The hot button this year, obviously, is this legislation because it's something that's been talked about for several years. Our people have a great deal of respect for the efforts of Representative Restrums and Norm in presenting this legislation and attempting to respond to a horrendous situation, as we all know. Our people have the same compassion that others have, and as we have in previous years, passed on to the Johnson family and to every other family that has been a victim of this type of a situation. It's insurmountable and something that we hope none of us would ever have to go through. Nevertheless, it's something that takes place. Our position has not changed as an association. We feel that this legislation by itself in reducing the age of certification is not necessarily an answer to itself. The interesting comment that was made today is that everybody seems to now be talking about reform. And that was one of the comments I wanted to talk about today, that we're there as corrections professionals to help you, to give you the best information that's available to that, and we want to be a part of that reform. We'd like to sit with you and talk about how can we expand this legislation? How can we make this work so that, that we do have better answers and that we provide public safety and yet rehabilitation for children? This document that I presented you, if you take the time to read this, on pages 8 and 9, it talks specifically about today's bill, the reasons why we have opposed this legislation, but it gives you some research material, the best material that we have available to us on a national basis, as well as other states are looking at the same issues on younger certification with it. So I don't need to expand and give you a lot of stats on stuff with it. I think this document speaks for itself, and we're available to you to answer questions, make further presentations to you upon your request. So thank you for giving us the time to present this today.
Thank you. We got a couple minutes left. I want to give one person in the audience the first one to stand up. You get 1 minute, and then we're going to go to the family, and we're going to go. We got to adjourn at noon, so we can't get everybody in.
Mr. Chairman, while your next testifier is coming up, I just want to put the committee chairman and the committee and Representative Westrom as the author on notice that if and when this bill is taken off the table later, that as chairman of the House Judiciary Policy and Finance, I'm asking that it be sent to us at that point on re-referral.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Go ahead, sir.
Al Powers, Mr. Chair, and first I want to tell that the family, the Johnson family, that if it was my child, I probably would be in the same position. But as an African American, I think this law will impact the disparity that's going on right now in the African American community and the juvenile justice system. That's why I'm here. Don't use the law to you use the Johnson family to set this law up, and it have an impact on our community. I believe the way the disparities is right now, and everything I've seen up there, I've seen pictures of white kids, white, you putting it halfway here, and like I said, the respect to that this family, we all, if it was my child, I would be sitting right where you are, and I wouldn't know how to act. So I don't know how to deal with that part. But I want to I just wanted to speak say to this committee that I'm very concerned about the disparities in what's happening to African American in the in doing intervention like Representative Moran was talked about, but having intervention and making sure the intervention dollars that come from this committee or this legislature, that it gets to the place it's supposed to go. It's not happening in a lot of things. So that's how I'm going to bring it. And I'm not here to represent Lil Johnny. I'm here to try to – we should come with solutions. And this one right here might not be the best thing to put 10-year-olds in prison. So I'm going to
– Sir, if you could keep it real short, because we're going to have you back. We'll take your name down, and when we bring the bill up again, you can testify. But go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, committee. My name is Troy Parker, and I just wanted to speak on the simple fact that even if we took adults with the same mental capacity of most of these children that we're talking about putting through the adult system, even majority of them adults would be wavered from being tried as adults because of the mental because of their diminished mental capacity. So why are we trying to deal with something in a way that really doesn't help our system, and then giving all that leverage to a prosecutor, which in other hand is also a politician, who then would be making decisions based on the support or lack of support for their elections and campaign, is going to then open up a whole other set of problems for us as a community and as a state. So I just hope, no matter what you do, that we take all them issues into account when we do make a ruling on this. And I thank you.
And respect thank you. People.
Thank you, sir. And if you could have the Johnson family come back up with Representative Westbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're not going to take any more public testimony. We're going to finish up with the family and Representative Westbrook, and then we're going to adjourn and lay it on the table. Go ahead.
With all due respect to the other testimony that we've heard, just some things to mention here. You know, we keep hearing about if he would have been tried as an adult, if this individual would have been tried for this particular crime, they would be getting out when they're 18. That's the issue that we have here at hand. If they were tried as an adult and getting out at 18, they still have no repercussions after that. The way that juvenile law is written right now, the record is expunged at 19. The state is no longer in control that way either. So we're looking at the lesser of two evils here. And we need to come to a compromise. We need to come to a consensus as how are we going to handle this? You know, we hear from the County Attorneys Association, they're not totally against it. That's the way that I read it. They just looked at the list of crimes is too long, and maybe the age is a little too low. Can we work together? Can we come to a compromise? Can we limit that number of crimes? And just to reiterate here, you know, again, in the juvenile system as we stand, they are always put into a least restrictive environment first. They cannot automatically be sent to Red Wing. They have to have a chance to mess up first. It's always the least restrictive environment. And that's why this individual that committed this crime to our precious daughter was not sent to Red Wing, was not sent to any of these other places, because he played the game very well. He spent 2 years in a detention center. He spent a year living with his aunt, simply on probation, to do what he would like, and he is now currently living with his parents, finishing out until his 19th birthday this summer. Is that what the juvenile system has done? Is that what we're looking for? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Mummer, do you want to make a closing comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, go ahead. During that testimony, I wanted to correct one thing. The records are kept till I believe it's 27 or 28, because I'm on that crime information committee. And
could you keep it quiet up in the crowd? Please stop the talking.
Okay, go ahead. The same judge that handled it somewhat leniently probably would have done the same if he was certified as an adult. But I just wanted to correct something that my colleague from my side of the aisle is new here, and when he referred to us, some of us, as liberals on crime, I think anybody that's been here for a while know that some of the people sitting on this side are some of the toughest on crime here. It's just we may view some ways of being smart on crime and stupid on crime, but I assure you that since I represent one of the highest crime areas in the state, I have, since day one, been trying to stop crime and work very hard on it. So, and just so that the others don't have to speak, that's, I know some of the others on our side also. So it's coming for not cross aisle. just wanted to clear something up.
Representative Westman, any comment before we lay your bill over for future consideration?
Real brief, Mr. Chair and committee members, I want to thank you for the dialogue and the good questions back and forth. I and I know the Johnsons appreciate our attention to this issue. Let me just refocus what we're really talking about here. First of all, the discussion about whether there should be punishment or not. I think there should be punishment. Some were advocating no punishment, and I think that is not the right way to help deal with such heinous crimes as this. But what this bill does, again, three things. Just lowers the age from 14 to 10, or pick the number, before a prosecutor to try and ask a judge based on many criterias, and one would be mental capacity. It's not a foregone conclusion that they would automatically be certified as an adult. It's not a foregone conclusion that they would automatically be designated EJJ. But right now, neither of those options are at the prosecutor's discretion or option as they evaluate the facts and as they try to bring justice to the system. So the two things we're doing is lowering it for EJJ, which still keeps it in the juvenile system but gives them an adult sentence that is stayed if they don't screw up again. That's not possible in this case. certifying them as adult is the second thing. Those are both things that will be left up to the courts and the defense and the prosecutors to make those cases. Third, we're asking for records in these violent felony crimes to not be expunged and not be gotten rid of before age 28. And the current law would allow for expungement. We're saying in these heinous crimes, it shouldn't be expunged. Those are the three things we're trying to work on. I just want to bring the focus back to those matters in this bill, and I look forward to discussing this further and working with parties to try to come to an improvement to our system.
Thank you, Representative Westbrook, and thank you also to the Johnson family for your testimony. I sure appreciate you being here. Our next meeting is going to, the bill is going to be laid over, and our next meeting date is February 15th at 10:15. Meeting adjourned.